And welcome to Rewind Reviews, a podcast where we take a look at old movies, more often than not, that we remember from the past. This week, Chris got to choose, and he chose Men in Black.
Here come the Men in Black. Little housekeeping pre... Oh, sorry, I talked over it. Let's do it again. Here come the Men in Black. Nice. And then obviously
I can't hear that song anymore without thinking of Phoenix Nights, though, which is really unfortunate. For those who don't recall or haven't ever seen it, Phoenix Nights is a weird British sitcom from like the early thousands, and there's like a they have like a local singer guy that's kind of like does bad covers of things, and he loses his job at one point, and you find him in the local supermarket singing "Come get your black bin bags." They're strong and thin and slender, or something like that. Hey, I think the second black point bin is, bags.
They're on offer till December.
Yeah, that's it. It's very good. But that's ruined that song for me forever, because that's all I'm ever going to hear now. But anyway.
And I know...
You had some housekeeping.
I know we're not talking... Oh, yeah. There's the next door having work done on their roof, so I don't know if that's going to be noisy at any point. If it is, I apologise. If it gets really bad, I'll try and move, maybe? But it seems to be
as right, I pointed out to Chris before we started, this podcast is usually a real shit show anyway, so I feel like a bit of extra noise isn't really going to take much out of the quality.
We figured, fuck it.
Mate, I'll be honest with you, mate. It's not the only thing that's different this week. I'm in the living room, which is very rare, and I always hate doing it in the living room because my couch is comfortable to sit back on, but horrible to sit forward on, which you need to for the mic. So
I will back that up. Your sofa's horrible to sit forward on. I will fully back that.
Yeah, 100%. It's a lovely sofa. It's great for watching TV because you can just sit back and enjoy it, but it is terrible if you need to lean forward for anything. I hate doing the podcast in here as a result. So today, Chris, I've rigged up my arm, attached it to a chair I've brought over, and I've got this whole rig set up so I can lie down and do the podcast. So for the first time ever, Chris, we've been doing this podcast for what? 10 years?
11 years?
11 years now? Yeah, heading to 11 years. I've never done a podcast lying down before, and I am fucking loving it.
Nice.
The best thing.
I think I have. There was a point where I didn't really have a clear setup in the flat the house Jess and I rented. Right. So I was sort of, I would often do it just led on the bed. I think I've done it led down. But it's not the, for me, it wasn't the, I think I did it led on the bed with the mic not in a particularly stable position. So I think if you've got a setup and you're making it work, I applaud you.
Mm. I'm happy with it.
I know we're not covering the sequel now, but just a quick one musically. If your first film had a tune that big as the soundtrack, mm-hmm. you just wouldn't bother trying again, would you? I mean, nod your head, Black Suit's Coming is just not as good, is it? And I don't know why they bothered trying.
Not as good, no. But, you know, I like Nod Your Head, Black Suit's Coming, and I think I've come to the conclusion that it just suffers from comparison. Like, if Nod Your Head, Black Suit's Coming had been the song at the end of this, you'd be like, yeah, great song. It might not quite be the classic mega hit this was, but that's a good song. That's a good song. I like, and I miss the old rap about the events of the movie at the end of the movie. I think Hollywood needs to bring that back. We need more. Like, you know, imagine if in the pursuit of happiness, it had just like there'd have been a rap at the end. That'd have been a way better movie.
Just soundtrack songs in general, I quite like. Like, I think we're missing out without them.
Yeah.
I really do. But Men in Black. So yes, so I chose Men in Black because I wanted. We've had some relatively obscure choices this year. We literally had a film neither of us had ever seen, and we had a which has got a bit of a cult following. We had a film nobody's really seen that has no following. So I wanted, before we went into the Indiana Jones trilogy, I wanted to do a classic Rewind Reviews choice, a proper film from our childhood that we could get all nostalgic about, and this is absolutely it. I remember watching this, just the typical, I think I had it on DVD, I don't think it was, I think I got it a few, I think it's one of those sort of kept borrowing the videotape from a friend, eventually got the DVD. I remember my cousin had the first two films in a DVD combo set, and I borrowed that a lot. I just remember this song being everywhere, the movie being everywhere. I don't think I watched it in the cinema. I think it was a VHS thing for me. Although maybe I watched it in the cinema. I actually can't tell you. But the fact that I don't know would suggest I didn't. Proper nostalgia for this one. Proper remember being a kid, you know, watching it on the TV and then being a kid, watching it again and again, and, you know, the kind of film you'd have on, you'd do other stuff, all that sort of thing. Similar story for you, I assume?
I did see this in cinema. I even can tell you which cinema. It was in Athlone in Ireland. It was where we would go to see the cinema. It's actually the same cinema I saw Rugrats in.
Nice.
And the tradition was we would go to the cinema and then we would go to Burger King, because there's a Burger King. It was like the cinema was kind of at the back of a shopping center, if my memory serves me correctly, and there was a Burger King towards the front of it. So you'd pass the Burger King. So we'd either eat before we saw the movie or eat after the movie, depending on what time the movie was, obviously. And I just remember sheer disappointment, because the Burger King had the toy that was the flashy thing. In the kids' meal. But there were several other toys that I thought were crap. One was like, you know, those coffee aliens. One was the little black circle with the red button on it. And there was a car. You'd attach a little toy car to it and you press it and that'd shoot off. That one wasn't terrible. Then there was like a spaceship that like span around like a Beyblade. But all I really wanted, Chris, was the flashy thing.
Well, of course. Yeah.
That was not the toy they had available that week. So I got the car with the button where you pushed it and the little toy car popped off. And I love that toy very much, but I wanted the flashy thing. And we went back. I dragged us back to Athlone to the Burger King multiple weeks following, without even when we were planning on going to see it, because I wanted that toy so bad and they never had it. So, disappointment. But love the fucking movie. So I was a weird alien kid. Like, I had, my granddad had old like magazines with like UFO conspiracy theories and stuff, and I was already into the idea of mysterious men in black. You know, that was a concept that was already within my sphere. So when this movie is being advertised, wherever it was advertised, maybe I just heard about it through the song, maybe I saw a bus ad for it, I don't know, maybe I saw some ads on TV for it, I don't exactly remember, but I just remember immediately, I need to see this movie. So we saw it really early, absolutely loved it, it's an incredible film, then had it on, you know, it's another one of those wore the VHS through sort of films. So yeah, big love for the movie as a kid, but my primary memory is the disappointment of not getting a toy, which is nothing to do with the film, but is at the same time, because I wanted the flashy thing. Although I've just googled the toys, and the flashy thing, it's this weird stubby version of it, because it's a plastic toy version, and it actually doesn't look much like the one from the movie, so, you know, and actually, to be honest with you, Chris, looking at it, it looks more like a shit vibrator.
I have nothing to say on that.
I am gonna send you this image so you can look at it.
It's also one of those things where, you know, that only does a car. You can you know, run it all over the floor and like play other games with it, and like, mm-hmm. you know, maybe your Power Ranger figure comes out of the Men in Black car or something like that. The memory thing, you know, it, once you realise that thing's not actually erasing anyone's memory, how much are you going to... do you know what I mean? I reckon you probably played with the car more than you would have played with the memory thing.
Maybe, I guess. But I think for me, like, it was like owning a thing that's in the movie. Mm. It's like, because the, you know, like, it's a replica of the thing that could be the thing from the movie. I don't know, I quite like... I've sent you the picture of the set. I never saw these two figures that are covered in goo. I don't know what that... I mean, it's obviously it's J&K covered in goo. But,
I don't remember. But the thing is, apart from the Power Ranger toys, which came in cornflakes or Frosties, I believe, wasn't much of a Happy Meal, Burger King toy meal kid.
Yeah, I mean, I only liked them when they were something like that you was from the film. Like, and I don't mean like a toy of the thing from the film. Like, it looked like a replica of the thing. I don't know why that always in you know, was exciting to me. But yeah, it doesn't look great. Now I'm seeing it in picture form. But yeah. Anyway, the movie. we sort of lost our format the last few episodes of this. So let's do a little bit of sort of non-spoilery review and talk about whether we recommend it, just overall thoughts, and say if we recommend it or not quickly first before we go into the specifics. That sound good?
Yeah, sounds good to me.
So you've rewatched it. I rewatched it yesterday. I assume you rewatched it last night?
Yes.
Yeah. How did we feel? How did we feel seeing it again? Did it hold up? Was the magic still there, Chris?
I felt good, man. Like I felt a real nostalgic glow that I potentially haven't really felt since we watched Good Burger. Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I felt a real comfort to Men in Black. I really enjoyed my memory of Men in Black was always enjoying the like almost not necessarily more, but really enjoying his discovery of the agency.
Yes.
Really, really enjoying him being a cop that gets converted and the test and then him trying on the suit. And I sort of that was the bit that was fresher in my memory, to be honest with you. But it was one of those things where as the film unfolded, other things sort of, you know, I knew where stuff was going before it went there. That sort of muscle memory. I had a blast. It's so much fun. Look, yes, there's, you know, this I think the movie's probably a little bit too short, actually.
Yep.
I think potentially there should be, there's a bit more character development to do. There's a bit more explaining the world in some cases to do. I think the Tommy Lee Jones character is particularly, you know, I would put the, if you give me an extra 20 minutes, I think I'm developing his story a bit more.
Yep.
But I kind of forgive it those flaws for being a fun 90-minute romp. I think it's exactly 90 minutes, actually. It's an hour and 37, but seven is basically the credits. So I sort of, I had so much fun with it, and it doesn't take itself too seriously. It sort of acknowledges that there's elements of the world that once you probe, you could get easily confused by.
Yeah.
I had enough fun to not worry about the script flaws, character flaws that I think you could level at this movie. I think, you know, it's not like the Tommy Lee Jones stuff they do doesn't work. It just would work better with a bit more time dedicated to it. Mm. But that was sort of the biggest, and obviously we'll talk more when we go spoilers about that, but whilst there were one or two things that were like, really? The point is, it wasn't, ugh, really? Or, ugh, that doesn't make sense. Or, ugh, but what about this? It was, cool, yeah, but, you know, but, yeah, I'm having fun. Who cares? It's a surprisingly simple plot. I hadn't quite remembered, in terms of things you discover watching it with that framework in your head, this happens, then this happens, then this happens. But I think there's a place for that. And I think fun action movies is one of those places. So I enjoyed myself. What about you, Daniel?
Do you think, this is a wider question, I suppose, so maybe this isn't the time and place, Chris, but do you think this is us judging an older movie by a modern standard? Do you think, like, movies have gotten better over time and we now...
Yeah.
We, you know... In a, this is going to be a weird thing to say, but in a post-Pixar world where family movies started to be more, right? They started to have characters and depth that maybe wasn't put into kids' movies pre sort of Toy Story. Or maybe it was. No, because even like Aladdin, which had a lot of really good stuff in it, was still quite, you know, in and out, keep it quick, keep it simple. You know, kids don't have the attention span, so we're not going to explore any of this. The stuff that's there is good, but you always... You know, how many of these movies, basically, have we reviewed where we've said, could have used 10, 20 minutes more to develop some of these character ideas? And I just wonder if that's us judging older movies by a modern standard, because the expectation today, in a modern movie context, is to explore that stuff more thoroughly. And I think at the time, the trend, the style, whatever how you want to phrase it, the leaning was towards quick, fast, make it make sense, make the character stuff work, but we don't really want to bog the movie down in boring, you know, what's happening in his home life? You know, we want them running around shooting aliens. And I think there's a part of me that goes, I do think the movie would be better with more context and more explanation of the concept of having to. I think the movie sort of like lays this incredible idea at your feet, which is like, you have to give up everything to do this. Your family, your friends, your, you know, you know, your partner, if you have one, you know. And then we literally, Agent Jay, Will Smith's character, just goes, cool, and has his entire life erased. And I think, yeah. I remember, not maybe in my first few viewings, because I was very young, but I think as I got a bit older and I rewatched this film, I did remember thinking, does he not have a family? Like, he makes that decision very quickly. And I'm not saying we need a scene of him going home into a family he's about to lose and, you know, sort of says goodbye to them for the greater good. That would massively bog the movie down, especially if you don't then have the time to do something with it later on, right? But it does raise a lot of interesting ideas that it then doesn't get to explore. And there's a part of you that just thinks, well, then why do that? Why do that at all? But I guess it's nice. I did feel warm and fuzzy. It's as simple as it is executed. I did feel some warm and fuzzies at the end of the movie. I'm not going to spoil what actually happened.
Oh, for sure.
I did feel some warm and fuzzies about how Tommy Lee Jones' character, Agent K, ends up. And so I just think, in general, do you think we judge these movies by a different standard these days? And that absolutely wouldn't have been a valid criticism in the 90s. They'd have gone, what are you talking about? It's a quick 90-minute family film. Shut up.
Absolutely. Because I think the modern-day version of this movie is, Will Smith's maybe not got much family, and he's you know, he's running away from his problems by getting into his cop work.
Right.
And then, but there's not a lot of room then for Will Smith to be the jaunty, funny character. I think the modern day version of this movie ends on the conclusion of, actually, you know what? We don't have to completely disappear. It's important we have some sort of humanity.
Right.
And therefore, you can tell your family, you know, something like that.
Right.
But it doesn't. I think that is a modern perspective. And I don't think in reality, you don't need that for this movie to be a good time. And if we weren't re-watching this and then reviewing it, I would maybe notice that, but not enough for it to be of note. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If Jess and I just threw Men in Black on one afternoon,
yes,
I'd be like, oh, what a great throwback film that is. I mean, I'll be honest with you, I enjoyed the fourth one, MIB International, because I wasn't, do you know what I mean? I wasn't watching it with a review frame of mind. And I know there are people that, you know, really tore that movie apart. But to me, all of these movies, all of the Men in Black movies, to some degree, are just fun action movies. And right. I'm all right with that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. Because I just think, like, not every movie has to be an overly complex thing. I think the reason you think that here, when we might not have in maybe another film, is quite simply because the breadcrumbs of something with more depth are there. So there's a yearning for, like,
explore that, right? Yeah.
Like, because that is such an interesting idea, having to give away your identity, your family, your friends. And they don't just drop a few breadcrumbs, really, even. They make it a big part of one of the other characters' plot lines, you know? So we'll talk about that in more depth. But, you know, overall, I absolutely had a blast. I had a similar experience to you rewatching it, where I had a lot more fun with the first half of the movie. Because the second half of the movie, the roller coaster is just a movie. It's just scene to scene. We go here. We're chasing this, and we're going here. And now here's the finale, and it's over. The first sort of 45 minutes, the sort of, as you'd put it, like the discovery of the world, you know, Agent J's, you know, falling into it is by far more interesting and entertaining than the sort of mission they then get sent on. But that stuff comes with loads of great material too. So, you know, some of the movie's most iconic scenes are in that second half. So, you know, like, you know, it's not really a major issue. It is very much like the opening half of the movie is way more strong. It's way more engaging, actually, I think is the word, than the second half of the movie. But other than that.
I think that's you and me. I think there are some people that would say the opposite, and I think it's because you and I are captured by the interesting threads and the mysteries, etc., of that first half. Because even as if it sounds like you were like me, and even as a kid, that was probably our favourite part of the movie, because right. It was, well, what's this about? What is he going to discover? It's like, for example, it's going to sound particularly wanky, but in terms of art, I'm the kind of person that would rather look at a photograph or a painting of a cityscape than a beautiful landscape, than a beautiful, you know, field or ocean or something like that. And I think because for me, it's all the windows on that photograph. It's the what's the adventure in that city? What's the, you know, that third window from the right on that building? What's going on in there? Mm. And I think we're just those sort of, I mean, maybe you're about to be like, no, Chris, give me a mountain view any day, and that's fab, not a problem at all. But I, you know, my inkling would be maybe you're quite similar to me in that regard, and I think it's us, you know, it's the writing, it's the writers in us, it's that side of things. So I think that's why we're particularly drawn to the first half of the movie. I wouldn't say for sure, and I'm not saying you necessarily did, but I wouldn't say for sure the first half of the movie is stronger. I think the first half of the movie appeals to our sensibilities, but there will be people out there that fucking love aliens getting blown up and roller coasters, and for them the second half of the movie will be to their sensibilities. But maybe I'm wrong, but it's interesting. God, that got fucking, that got deep. I mean, about my back, didn't it?
I mean, ultimately, I agree with you. That was really wanky. I was holding that in the whole time you were speaking. I'm not sure your analogy 100% works, because I think a nice painting of a landscape can have lots of really interesting detail in it as well. But I think I take your point.
What would you rather look at? And this isn't to prove my point. I'm just intrigued now. Would you, if someone was to say to you, you can look at this photo of a gorgeous ocean or a photo of a cityscape view,
you've chosen ocean, which is a desolate, there's nothing in it, but like, one of my favorite paintings of all time is the wanderer above a sea of clouds, which is the Caspar David Friedrich painting, which is a man looking at a mountain range that is covered in cloud. And it sort of represents possibility, you know. I think it was, what is it? Wander above a sea of fog. I've just quickly googled to get the exact title of the painting. It's an incredible painting. It's one of my favorites. It was my phone background for a very long time. I love it because there's so much. It's a painting about the possibilities of your life. You know, it's incredible. So I'm not sure in terms of, again, I don't think your point is incorrect. You know, we like the sublime. We like that idea that of an interesting world with lots of possibilities, and I think you could find that in as much in a landscape as you can in a cityscape. But in terms of your point, I agree with you. Like
you
didn't pick the cleanest analogy, but I agree with what you're actually saying.
Yeah, and I think there is some truth in the, at least the analysis of us as people, because even your example of a landscape image has a man in it, like looking, do you know what I mean? What's he thinking? What's he doing? You know what I mean?
Right. So, yeah. 100%. Yeah. Yeah. But like, I do think you're right. I think we like, both you and I like a nice complex lived in world where it feels like there's a lot of stuff that exists that we don't yet know, and it's always extra fun when you have a really funny, likable character to go on that journey of discovery with, and they write Agent J so well as someone who kind of goes with this stuff. You're on that journey with him, you want to go with them on that, you know what I mean? It's like, it's exciting to discover that world, and you know, they only will touch the surface. Like, there's just constantly little references to wider things that are happening, and they're never going to explore them. It's not the point. The point is to make the world feel lived in and like it has really always been this way. And it works. And I think that is enjoyable. And there's something to that. And I think there's an element of the more he uncovers, the more exciting and interesting it is. And then you get to a point where he's in the world, you're set, you know what everything is, and now it's just have an adventure within it, and we're not exploring it as much at that point. You know, we're exploring the one plot line that's our focus, which is fine. And there's, again, I wouldn't change a word of the script. This isn't one of those criticisms where I'm like, I wish they'd done it this way. It's more of a just an observation as to why I prefer the first half to the second. But yeah, I think that's exactly what it is, 100%. And it's the same reason we like Steven Universe. Steven Universe is full of that stuff. You know, small hints to a wider world. It's that, again, it's that idea of the sublime. You know, what's just outside of the viewer's scope in the presented text? What are we suggesting lies outside of your field of view?
You know,
even that painting I just described, you know, the wander above a sea of fog, like a lot of the landscape is covered in fog in that photo. You know, what's just outside of your view? Well, that's what's exciting. So yeah, I 100% think that's what it is, for sure.
So let's go. Recommend.
Like, that was a really unfortunately wanky discussion, so let's just do the basics. Like, it's extremely funny, it's very entertaining, the plot's put together very well, the characters are very strong, like all of the stuff you want a movie to be doing is there, right? It's not just that stuff about the world building. It's a really great movie on all levels, so massive recommend before we get into the more details. So yeah, if you haven't already seen it, you should absolutely watch it. If you haven't seen it in a while, I do recommend cracking it out. And yeah, now we'll get into a more spoiler review for those who have joined us for that part.
So is this Dan? And this is crazy. I mean, we say this a lot, but we're like, what, 5 seasons into Rewind Reviews? Mm-hmm. Is this our first Will Smith movie?
That can't be, can it?
I think it is.
How? That's not possible. I know. Surely. Wait, let me. Yeah, I'll bring up the list.
I think it is. Obviously, we did the animated Aladdin, but
I hate. So since I've switched from Mac to Windows, one thing that's bothering me is the notes program I've got on Windows isn't anywhere near as easy for finding notes. And I've got a list of the previous episodes of Rewind Reviews that I can for quick reference, but I can't get to it quickly anymore because of the way it's structured now. Give me a sec. Rewind Review list. Here it is. I got it. Okay.
So I think it is. We didn't do Hitch, did we? So
no. So let me have a quick skim. Got the list in front of me now. Unless Will Smith had a secret role in The Snowman, it's not looking good. Oh my god, this might actually be our first Will Smith movie.
I think it is. So,
mate, we did Rent a Kid before we did a fucking Will Smith movie.
I know, it's nuts, isn't it? And he was a big, like, actor of our childhood.
Huge, yeah. I'm just quickly skimming the end of the list, just in case. But no.
Like,
I mean,
you think of the other
The closest we came, we discussed Will Smith a fair bit when we did
Aladdin,
because, of course, his involvement in the live-action remake. But, yeah. Wow.
Because, I mean, you think about tentpole actors from sort of the 90s, early noughties. You got, you know, your Robin Williams, your Jim Carrey. Like, we've done a lot of those actors. Like, but anyway, all that to say, Will Smith is amazing in this movie.
I think he makes the story work and Tommy Lee Jones makes the comedy work. And that's why it's such a good duo.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Because I think without Tommy Lee Jones being the straight man, Will Smith's reactions, if everyone was reacting like Will Smith to the world, Will Smith's reactions aren't funny anymore. You know, Jim in The Office is the reason, you know, Michael Scott's funny. Because you have a normal person in the situation observing it for its absurdity. You know, here they've kind of flipped that a little bit because actually it's an absurd world that Will Smith is reacting to, and that's the comedy. But you've got Tommy Lee Jones, who's so basically bored by it. And without those reactions or lack of reactions in a way, I think a lot of the comedy in this movie would fall apart. And then in terms of a story, Will Smith's such a likable character. You're on that journey with him, as we discussed. They're both great and very, very well positioned and cast in this particular film. I don't think I would want any other casting. We have a couple of alternates in the triv, but I don't know. No, I don't think so.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think their chemistry is phenomenal. And mm-hmm. like you say, it's that's banging, but it doesn't look like it's being picked up. They're both...
It's fine. Like we've warned the listeners. If you can hear banging, congratulations. It's like being in a house where the people next door are doing their roof. We're going for 3D sound on our podcasts now. We're giving you guys some ambient noise. Maybe I'll add some bird tweeting to my side, just so it balances out.
It doesn't. There's no line on the mic, so hopefully it's okay. Because they're both also...
I'm relaxy man down today, Chris. I'm led down. I don't care.
Can you hear it? That's usually a good game.
No, I couldn't hear it at all. I couldn't hear it at all. I could hear that.
Yeah, that's definitely being picked up on the mic.
Are they on your roof?
Huh?
Are they on your roof?
No. I might see if I can... See if I can move, maybe.
Nah, we're fine.
We'll see if it continues. So not only are they brilliant together, but they're also brilliant at doing what they're doing on their own. Like a lot of Will Smith's asides, a lot of his mm-hmm. thing. And the moment that really got me, the moment, and it happens so early on, it's when Tommy Lee Jones turns to the police officer and says, don't mess with me, son. You have no idea who you're dealing with. I was like, oh, there's so much charisma and authority and presence in the way he switches and delivers that line with with authority. It's brilliant.
It almost made me think, like, if Doctor Who was American, Tommy Lee Jones might have made a really good Doctor. As grumpy as that man can be, I think he'd have made a really good early Doctor.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair.
Yeah. I'd never thought of it until I rewatched this time, but I was like, yeah, he's got, you're right, it's authority and charisma mixed. He's very talented, even if he is a bit of a grumpy guy. What was it he said about Jim Carrey after doing the Batman movie? It's like, I cannot sanction your buffoonery. I mean, look, we've all seen the documentary of Will Smith on the set of Man on the Moon. So
Man on the Moon. Yeah.
I think Tommy Lee Jones, fair. Who doesn't come out of that story smelling of roses, that I don't know if anyone doesn't know. We've told it a few times, I think, across this podcast, but they worked together, obviously, as the Riddler and Two-Face in the Batman movie. And Tommy Lee Jones famously hated Jim Carrey during that time. And when Jim Carrey asked him why, he said he cannot sanction his buffoonery, which is just an amazing sentence for anyone to utter. But having seen how Jim Carrey works on sets from that documentary, I think Tommy Lee Jones is probably right.
Yeah, just how Jim Carrey can be on red carpets is fairly intolerable, isn't it? So.
Yeah. So I'm on board with Tommy Lee Jones. I think he's got a reputation he probably doesn't deserve. Because even Nadia said yesterday, how did they get him in this movie? I don't know, what do you mean? She's like, I was like, well, you know, he probably thought the script was funny, or it was a one for them, one for me kind of situation. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think people have this real impression of Tommy Lee Jones being like this deeply cranky person, but I just think I just think Hollywood is such a circus, and he's just no time for any of it. He's just like, no, no, I'm not sitting through this, and I kind of respect that about him.
Yeah, and if you look at his CV's got a fair amount of fun things in. Like, although there is a run, like, God, Batman Forever, Volcano, and Men in Black is it's hell of a run of out there movies, isn't it?
Mm. Speaking of the cast, actually, we should, of course, anyway. if we're doing the cast, the late great Rip Torn as Agent Zed, a fucking brilliant actor. I loved him in this movie as a kid. Love him in the movie now. He's so much fun to watch. What a loss he was. It was a few years ago he died now, 2018, 2019-ish. But tremendously good in this movie.
Yeah, he's fantastic. Again, lots of presence, lots of world weariness, but just also really effective. And that man had like a career. He did a shitload of stuff.
Yeah, I remember him. He had a small run on like 30 Rock, I remember.
Did he?
I don't think it was like a collection of episodes that were together. I think he just like recurred like across a couple of seasons. I feel like he was like maybe a rival to Jack Donaghy. I can't remember exactly, but he was great in that too. You know, he did Dodgeball. He just worked and worked and worked. Like you couldn't. And I'm pretty sure was he. I'm pretty sure he's part of one of the what I think is genuinely one of the worst scenes ever committed to film, but in a very iconic way, which is I think if I'm not mistaken, I think he plays Freddy's dad in Freddy Got Fingered. So you know that famous "Daddy, would you like a sausage?" "Daddy, would you like some sausages?" That scene. I think that's Rip Torn that's like chasing him around the living room during that whole sequence. He's great. He's never given a bad performance, that man.
But to be honest with you, I don't think there's a single bad performance in the whole thing. Linda Fiorentino is also very good. You know, the voice acting, the Frank the dog is brilliant, like you know, everyone's
and we haven't even mentioned fucking Vincent D'Onofrio absolutely killing it as Edgar the Bug. Just an incredibly upsetting performance. The physicality he brings to that role. Holy hell. Absolutely deeply upsetting in all the right ways.
Yeah, it's so well realized. And it's kind of, I think he, if you do like that roller coaster ride stuff, you know, this man knows he's in a comic book movie, essentially. Like, well, it is literally a comic book movie, isn't it? This man knows what movie he's in, and he's delivering for that movie.
Can you believe he's the kingpin now? Like, it's so funny to think he's the most intimidating, you know, like one of the most intimidating villains Marvel has, and here he is, like playing an intimidating for a very different reason character. You know, it's great. I love him. He was also in the Jurassic Park movies and stuff. The Jurassic World, I think, movies. I like him as well. Linda Fiorentino, for anyone going like, oh, yeah, I remember her. She was great. What happened to her? I think she was very unfortunately, I'd have to double check this, but my memory is that she is unfortunately one of the actresses that got quote-unquote blacklisted for being quote-unquote difficult. And I think what they mean by difficult means spoke her mind. There's a handful of these actresses. They're usually from like the 80s and 90s. And they basically, you know, were open and honest like they should be. And spoke what they said what they wanted to because that is their right. And Hollywood just labeled them difficult and brushed them to the side. And just hired different actresses who were more pliable instead.
Because she was really good in Dogma as well, wasn't she?
Yeah, like, she's great.
She's a good actress.
Yeah, really good actress. That sort of got shoved aside for being sort of dubbed as difficult, which is just awful, absolutely awful. Because she's very talented, and I would have really enjoyed seeing her do more stuff. But
well,
that's not to be.
You know, we've done cast. What else did you like? What else were you struck by when rewatching?
I was struck by how much of the humor was verbal, because my memory, when you say think of the jokes in this movie, I remember the ball thing spinning around and trashing the office. I remember him delivering the squid baby, you know, and in the background, the slamming him around and stuff. I kind of remembered one or two lines, like, you know, the one that he improvised famously, which is the, "It'd just be raining black people in New York," which I thought was very funny, but he improvised that. So my memory of the movie was that it was a lot of the comedy was physical. You know, what's his face pulling his skin back? The dog, you know. Actually, I wrote down so many lines of dialogue that made me really laugh. And I wonder if this is one of those movies that's so successful because it's got a lot of slapstick stuff for kids to enjoy, physical comedy. And then it's got a lot of like more subtle dialogue ones, some that I don't think I ever picked up on as a kid. Like, I don't think I was ever really listening to what Edgar was saying as that ship comes and crashes into his truck. But for anyone who doesn't remember, we'll quickly recap the plot in a minute as well so people know what we're talking about. But he basically says the only thing that pulls its weight around here is my goddamn truck. And on the word truck, his truck explodes. And then he sticks his head out the door, sees the truck on fire, and just goes, figures. Which is just amazing.
He's very nonchalant about his truck exploding. Yeah, considering the bad mood and how much of a dick he's being to his wife. He's very like, figures.
Yeah. I also really enjoy Will Smith saying he's just really excited and he has absolutely no clue why we're here. That was both delivered well and is a dialogue-based joke. I also like, we at the FBI have no sense of humor that we're aware of. Amazing. I wrote down so many. The other one that cracked me up was when he's shaking the dog, which is funny in itself, but Agent J turns around to the passersby and says the dog owes my friend money, which really cracked me up.
And then does he say they're practicing a one-woman play or something?
Yeah. Then the final one I'll mention, which isn't even dialogue, but it was text-based. So Zed is reading out the message they're getting from the enemy aliens, and it says, "We deliver the galaxy or we will destroy the Earth." And that's what he repeats in a moment of seriousness to J and K. Like, it's like, we're in trouble now. You need to get the galaxy back or the Earth will actually be destroyed. So he reads it out, "Deliver the galaxy or we will destroy the Earth." But what we can see on screen is the full message, and the actual full message reads, "Deliver the galaxy or we will destroy the Earth. Sorry." It's such a great gag, and I absolutely did not spot that when I was a kid. So what I think struck me about the movie's comedy is that it's quite layered in the tone they're approaching with it. They've gone, well, we'll do some of this kind of humor, we'll do some of this kind of humor, we'll do some of this kind of humor, and as a result, like, the movie, you'd think that would make it a messy movie tonally, but I just think it means it works. It's got something for everyone. I think that's just what it means. Like, I think an adult will watch it and get something we'll be laughing at different moments to a child, but that's absolutely fine. That, if anything, that's a benefit. Because they could have stuck to one of those kinds, but instead they did a lot. So I was very struck by, the movie was a lot more fun. No, a lot more funny than I remember. I knew the movie was fun, but I don't remember it being quite so laugh out loud funny. And it was very much so.
Yeah, I agree. And especially some of the ones you mentioned, the jokes coming from the dialogue really struck me as well. It's a very, it's especially for, you know, 90 minutes, 97 minutes. It's a very dense script in terms of the jokes and stuff.
Yeah. Very quick recap of the plot then, and we'll sort of break down some of the plot elements. I think, so basically the story is, Will Smith's character, whose name I forget because they erase it. He's just J in the credits because he's Agent J. It's Agent J and Agent K. Basically he...
It's James something.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember. They do say it, but it's gone from my brain right now. It'll come back to me later and I'll blurt it out in the middle of you giving a big long speech or something. Like, you'll be like, it'll making a really interesting point, and I'll just suddenly yell out the name. That's what'll happen.
No, what's more likely is I'll be talking about paintings and you'll just be like, James.
So he basically discovers aliens living in New York, and he stumbles onto this plot. The plot is basically MIB have existed for, you know, dozens of years. They basically started when aliens came to the Earth, and the first people who made contact with them realized that they were just refugees, but they knew regular humans wouldn't be able to tolerate them. They knew that they would be panicky and it would cause more trouble than it was worth. So instead, they've secretly allowed them to live amongst people only on Manhattan, which I think is a brilliant idea, because Manhattan is the one city on Earth, of course, where there are like crazy people all over the place and you barely think about it, which I think that's actually really genius as an idea. I'm not even sure that part's in the comic. I think in the comic it's just wider. I think in the movie specifically, the premise is that it's up there all in Manhattan. And the MIB, a division formed since to help you know, keep them in check, keep the, you know, the regular folk from finding out they're living amongst aliens. And they're kind of like, they're bureaucrats. They're not really necessarily earth-saving. They you know, they exist to sort of just like, you know, keep them in check. Like, oh, you're outside of the city limits, you know, come on back. Like, they're like, you know, they're like ICE, but for aliens, for literal aliens, not illegal aliens. And basically, an alien comes to the planet, Bug. He's looking for something called a galaxy, and because he's killed someone to get it, the species that guy is from think that the MIB are responsible, or holding Earth and the MIB responsible, and are saying, return the galaxy to us or we'll blow it up. So they have to get it back from the bad guy by a certain countdown. Agent J sort of falls into this. Agent K is sort of on the other end of his career, looking to maybe get out. And then they go solve the mystery and get the thing back. And then the end of the movie, which is like so lovely, K retires, and we get to see that he's reunited with the woman that he left behind. Because to join the MIB, you've got to leave your life behind, and he gets to reunite with the long lost love of his life, and they have a good cover story for it. Structurally, it's such a sound film. Like, it's really tight. It goes by at a clip, but at no point do you ever feel like the pacing is wrong. I mean, I don't know if that's only something you came across, because I had no point where I was like, the pacing here is a problem.
No, if anything, like, when I saw that it only had 20 minutes left, I was like, oh, it's such a shame that it's only got 20 minutes left. And maybe the very end feels a little bit rushed, those last sort of 4 minutes. But again, that's nitpicking. Otherwise, I think the pace is perfect, which is surprising, really, given how late he sort of, how far into the movie it is until he's actually, you know, Will Smith's character is full on in with the Men in Black. But I think part of the cleverness of that, and part of the reason you don't view that as a pacing issue, mm-hmm. is because of how they embed the aliens throughout. You know, this opens on an alien bug, and then the crash, and we're following Edgar, and because of that, it feels like it's not right. No alien action, and then suddenly a shitload of alien action. The alien action is peppered throughout as a result, yes. of how they divide up that first act.
Yeah, and you know what? That's something they do really well with Ghostbusters as well. Because, like, in Ghostbusters, like, you know, there's a version of that movie where they don't really actually encounter ghosts until quite far into the film, but the movie opens with a sequence of it. So, you know, and as does this. It's probably wise, because I feel like sometimes these movies, they stick too strictly to the point of reference character for the audience. So then you don't see what's happening in the wider world. But I think feel free to show us some other stuff, like to you know, because that's just more enticing. Because it's like, oh, I want to know more about this world. I'm seeing glimpses of it, but I'm not, you know, in it yet. And it sort of invests you more in, like, the point of view character and his journey into that world. In this case, I thought the pacing was pretty good. I could have always used 10-15 minutes more to just sort of like flesh out a couple of the ideas. But again, nothing like doesn't work. You know, it's all really clear. The flow of the movie is so specific that you know nothing ever is really confusing about it. You understand why everyone is doing what they're doing. Yeah, it all sort of opens up in a really obvious way. And yeah, I just think it flows really nicely. So you said you found the ending a little rushed. How did you find the climax? Because, you know, it's an action sequence, but not a traditional one. There's no sky beam. They're not like, you know, it's more about problem solving than it is a fight, per se. What did you think about that? Because I feel like a modern version of this, there's a lot more firing of guns and, you know.
Yeah, sort of... I think it's a bigger set piece in a modern version of this. But actually, I think it works really well. I think, you know, the character we've grown to like is in trouble. It links back to the beginning kind of origins of the Men in Black. I think we've got some pretty epic action scenes before that, you know, and the tunnel is exciting. The sort of the payoff of the big red button in the car. So I think they do the work in the movie to make you not need a sky beam and stuff. This is, you know, I think this movie could be looked at by a lot of modern movies as a good way to build to a finale, you know.
Yeah, and all the pieces are like laid out throughout the entire movie, aren't they? It's not, you know, when it all comes together, you understand the stakes really clearly because you know what it would mean if he got off the planet with the galaxy. You know what why he's climbing that tower. You know what he's getting out of that. Like it's, you know, it's all sort of, it does all sort of crescendo quite neatly.
Yeah, I think so, and it all comes. If you think about the number of things that come together in that last sequence, the origins, his relationship with her, the decision to not memory wipe her, and that's been a theme throughout. Tommy Lee Jones' character's arc crescendoing, and in that moment, which links back to the opening moment, that clever twist of I wasn't training a, you know, we think he is training a partner because because we've seen his old partner disappear, but actually that notion that he's training his replacement, it all comes together so beautifully and is an example of, whilst, you know, we've talked about how we think they could have done a bit more with the Tommy Lee Jones arc, actually it feels like every decision in that last kind of set piece sequence is geared towards the characters. So that's, you know, that's great.
Do you think they do enough? Because, so by the end of the movie, right, so first of all, I think it's insane that without any further training or information about...
Oh, of course it is. Yeah.
they just give him guns, Jay specifically, and he's just running around causing absolutely chaos with no training, no understanding of who any of the alien species, very much on the job training. And then, like, that is their first mission, and it ends with... Kay retiring, which means that like he's gone from his first mission to his second mission, he's the boss. Now, admittedly, we don't know how much time has passed by the final scene. Presumably a certain amount of time because they have that fun idea.
No, we do. We know exactly. It's in the dialogue. Will Smith says something like, that was quite a lot for a second day on the job or something. It's like, literally stated.
Yeah, no, I mean, sorry, in terms of the end scene when it's like months later.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because there's the scene where he's later on with, who I guess is Agent L. I mean, she's Laurel.
Yeah,
the character,
it seems so.
Linda Frontino's. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's Jay and L. You know, and he's talking with all this knowledge and confidence about the world of aliens now, and the idea is he's learnt it now, and he's kind of the, you know, he's the lead agent, and she's learning from him.
I thought that when he like blows her mind with the fact about Dennis Rodman, I was like, has he just been doing a lot of homework? Has he been reading a lot of files while she's been
how much time
getting set up in her uniform? Like,
right. Yeah, so I thought that was really interesting. I like it, and I also like that what they're dealing with when we see them at the end isn't another sort of thing that's going to be like a threat. It's literally like a diplomatic situation. You know, these aliens from this planet, you know, want to visit and see a basketball game involving Dennis Rodman because he's from their planet. You know, it's a diplomatic thing. You know, it's not like they're not necessarily alien police. You know, their job is wider. Their scope is wider than that, and that's actually what I really enjoy about this interpretation of the MIB, is that it is more about that than it is like policing. So yeah, that's quite fun. But yeah, I wondered a lot throughout this movie how irresponsible it was to just let Jay onto the streets with Kay with no training of any kind on the specifics of the alien situation. The fact that he's constantly just like not telling him stuff for presumably his own amusement. Like when Kay gives Jay the cricket, the gun, the small gun, you think he'd have said, hey, just so you know, so you don't fire that like inside. That's going to blow you back. That gun is crazy powerful. It looks small, but it's going to kill a person if you're not careful. He just lets him fire it. Like, he could have killed someone. Like, there's so much of that in this movie. If I was going to nitpick corner, Chris, and I think what I've done is I've bought the bus ticket, but I think I'm not going to get on the bus. But I think, like, when the bug gets on the ship and is taking off, and they both fire essentially alien rockets at the ship, and it crashes and slides towards them, and it stops just in front of them, and it's a really badass moment. My nerd brain is going, first of all, risky as fuck. You could have killed everyone in that baseball stadium if it had crashed into that stadium. Not cool. But two, there's no actual way for anyone to have arranged it so it would stop right in front of their feet. You can't, you know, an exploding ship, that debris is lying anywhere. And Kay's confidence that it's going to stop before it gets to them, as badass as it is, makes literally no sense. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's throughout this movie, isn't it? Like,
right.
You know, like Jay just, you know, looking at one corpse and just sending Jay to just look at another one without... And also, why doesn't Jay call him over when his head starts to pop open? Why doesn't he rush over when he can hear that commotion going on? Like, there's a lot of moments like that throughout this movie.
Yeah, and while it does often lead to good comedy, there is an element of it being slightly world-breaking. But I guess you could brush it off as that's just specifically Kay's unusual training style. You know, that's specific to Kay, and that if anyone else had been training him, maybe he'd have been trained a bit differently. So there's a lot of fun to be had with that stuff. Did you have other thoughts, or do you want to start looking into like some of my notes, or...
No, I'm happy to go with notes. I think it's weird. We have this all the time. Good comedies are almost, you know, to be fair, we have been talking for nearly an hour, but good comedies are almost, it's sometimes, you know, good comedies are never going to be a 2 hour, 2.5 hour episode.
No.
Because, you know, you don't want to just repeat the jokes fundamentally. But
and as we established, the story to this is actually pretty straightforward. There's not a lot to analyze or nitpick there.
Here's a question for you then, Dan. Did you, because watching it as an adult, the cat Orion twist, so basically the thing is the galaxy is on Orion's belt. Do you remember whether as a kid you got that, or were you surprised by that?
You mean got it like before they clear it up?
Yeah.
Although
like,
they don't really, when they do clear it up, Will Smith never actually says the line, the cat's name is Orion. You only know that if you're paying attention four scenes earlier when they're in the guy's flat, and if you look at the shrine to the cat, the words Orion are written under one of the photos. No one ever actually out loud says it, I noticed.
She does in the very next scene. He looks at the cat and goes, Jay? And then it cuts to her, the cat jumping on the desk, and she goes, you're after attention. And she looks at his belt and goes, Orion. So it's pretty...
Oh, okay, you're right.
I think it's fairly...
Yeah. He never says that, but obviously we know he knows it because he saw the shrine. You're right.
You've still got to be paying more attention than you would in some other, like, fundamentally family action movies.
I don't remember, but I would assume that the very first time I didn't get it until they revealed it. And then I have to assume that subsequent viewings, obviously, I very much was like, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Like, I have to assume
as an adult,
that as a kid, I didn't put it together. Do you
think
it's too
adult,
obvious?
No, I don't think it's too obvious at all. It's just as an adult, you're like, why are we focusing in on this cat so much if he's not important?
Do you think if someone goes in blind today, they would?
Yes, I think an adult would get it, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, that's fair.
That's the other thing about this movie, isn't it? Even though, you know, a lot of the technology, it's not very dated, is it? Like, do you know what I mean?
We should talk about that, actually. Yeah, there's a lot of aliens in the movie, varying sorts, and the special effects are really good. I mean, it might just be that they've combined practical with CG, but, like, it all looks really good. Like, it all holds
like
up.
The CG marble galaxy thing at the end, whilst a fun idea, doesn't look brilliant in terms of CGI.
Oh, yeah,
because
that's like entirely CG. It looks like it's from a video game.
Even though it's kind of older cars and whatever, actually, like, even in the movie, in the context of the movie, it's an old car. But also, the technology, you know, it's not like they're using flip phones. It's computers, which we still have, and they're fairly generic looking. Like the aesthetic in general of this movie, when you think about the fact that this movie is nearly 20 years old, it really doesn't feel dated at all. And that's impressive.
Yeah. I think that's true from just a filmmaking perspective and like a story choices and perspective, like stuff, the aesthetic, the visual effects, all that stuff. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that's the other reason this is a classic. I do think there's an element of timelessness to the movie.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's not a lesson they learn. Although I enjoy the fourth one, that's not a lesson they learn with the fourth one. Like a lot of that is the technology isn't generic for the time. It's very specific to the time in terms of like my memory of the cars and the scene in the nightclub and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
the motorbike, etc. So yeah,
I looked up the character's original name, by the way, but I couldn't bring myself to interrupt you earlier to say it when I found out. James Darrell Edwards,
there you go.
Mr. Edwards, I guess.
What are your notes? Give me your notes, boy.
I like a classic 90s movie move. Credit the first half of the credits at the beginning of the movie. That always feels nostalgic to me now. I'm glad we've shifted to all the credits are at the back end of the movie now. But having, you know, the sort of non-rolling credits earlier in the film does always fill me with nostalgia, even if I prefer it the other way around. Like, I'm glad we've gone away with it, but it is such a sign of the time the movie was made. You know, following the bug around. The music.
And that feels like it's going on for a while.
Yeah, it definitely does. It definitely does. But they always did. I mean, I don't know if you remember, the ones from Space Jam are the same. Like, they just go on and on. Like, it's just, yeah.
Hey, will everyone a jam? If you want a jam, it's fine.
Like, well, I don't know if you remember, they did it in Short Circuit 2 also, and it was like the footage, how they did it. Short Circuit 2 was way cleverer because they did a bunch of like jokes during it. Because if you remember, Short Circuit 2's version of that was the little toy version of Johnny Five escapes and is running through a mall and causing all sorts of chaos. Like, it's going into changing rooms and like scaring people, and it gets into a lift, bumps off a door and comes out. And there's movie happening alongside the credits. It goes on for a while, but it is, you know.
Even going back to, you know, Space Jam, it's the story of it's Michael Jordan's career and, you know, Michael Jordan growing up. Like, but I think it's not that these ones are particularly marvelous or interesting. It's that they're not a bug roaming around the night sky.
which isn't anything really.
Yeah, I don't think the ones we've mentioned are particularly amazing. This one in Men in Black is particularly dull.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's fair. Yeah, although the music is so good, and I want to talk about the music. The music in this movie is fantastic. I have no idea who did the music, but it's great. So I could look that up, I suppose. Let's see. No, that's the cast. I want to know. My brain. But it's such good music. It kind of has a Danny Elfman vibe to it, but without... I don't think it is actually Danny Elfman. I assume it's not. I suppose it could be. There's the writing credits. Music. Oh... music by Danny Elfman.
There you go.
Yeah. I should have known. It's really good, though. I think his style fits this very well. I think this is, like, great use of him. So, it's perfect stuff. I like that our introduction to the world and characters is through, like... it's sort of layered in that it's the actual sort of, you know, normal American authorities pulling up a truckload of illegal aliens in the traditional sense of the phrase for it to then become about space aliens also, you know, illegally traveling. And that they're very quick to introduce you to how weird the movie's going to be. The whole thing where, you know, Kay's talking to him and he doesn't understand Spanish. And then when he takes off the hood and he's just holding his head on a stick. It's like such a creative visual, and it looks really good. Like, as an effect, it's great. And I just think everything about that sequence is just a really great way to introduce it to the world. I made a few notes about how much I enjoyed that.
I'd agree. I thought it was done very well.
We talked about that. I think making Jay's introduction linked to the overall plot. Like, that guy he chases at the beginning knows the bug is coming. So Jay, you know, you're progressing the what will become the overarching problem while we're introducing Jay to the world. It's not like the first thing Jay does is solve another smaller case. Even the guy who's having the baby, the squid baby, he's leaving the city because of the bug being in town. That's why they go after that guy, you know. So that's all really good. I think that's just a clever way to sort of make sure you're balancing your script. You know, you're building both plots simultaneously. We haven't talked about it yet, but Tony Shalhoub in this movie as Jeebs, a sort of pawn shop owner that secretly sells alien guns. I love Tony Shalhoub. Mm-hmm. I'll take Tony Shalhoub in any time of the day.
Yeah, I thought he was great, and David Cross as well. You know, I'd forgotten he was in this movie.
Yes. It's a small role, but it's good.
I thought his scene was a lot of fun as well.
Yes, yeah, some fun little cameos in the movie for sure. I made a bunch of notes about the interview process. I thought that was really fascinating as a sequence. Just what they were looking for, like the fact he just, you know, in a weird way, one of the things he does that's actually quite good is he doesn't just immediately shoot the snarling aliens just because they look snarly and alien-y. Although the thing that he shot the little girl is kind of funny in its own, you know, its own right. But, like, the idea that he knew not to just randomly fire, like, and his explanation of what his logic was, even though he's half joking, like, oh, I was going to pop this guy on the street lamp, but then I was like, ah, he's just doing some exercising, you know. He's just doing pull-ups. It's just a really great sequence, and I think it says a lot about what they're looking for, but it tells us a lot about him as a character too.
Yeah, I'd agree.
I like that it's like 37 minutes in and Jay is in the MIB. like that's such a tight turnover as scripts go. I also made notes about how they do lots of subtle character stuff in that, like, Jay keeps wanting to give people happier readjusted memories. It says a lot about him as a person, you know.
Yeah, and it's, in a way, I think the ending is right and makes sense, but in a way you almost wanted them to stay together because you know, Tommy Lee Jones's character also, Kay, is learning from him too, you know. There's the bit where he obviously relents and says, give us some happy memories, and I just think, you know, you almost want to see more of them learning from each other. And I did love the notion that, having seen him look at the woman he'd left behind on the screen, I love the notion that Jay, when he wiped his memory, said to him, you've been in a coma, you're going to wake up and find the girl. Go look for her and fall in love and be happy. That's what happened in my head. That's how he ended up with her.
Yeah.
Because Jay saw that and encouraged it during the memory wipe.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose if he set the memory wipe to when Kay met aliens, he was on his way to see that girl that night, wasn't he? That's why he had the flowers. So I guess he would have immediately been thinking of her anyway. But I think that's right. I think he's pushed him into
it. Yeah, but it's in the same vein that he tells that woman in another really funny scene, which is based on dialogue, when he's like, and you know what? You go out and you get yourself some clothes and you threw him out. And the way he's like, and then maybe get some decorating done. Like, I think he was like, I 100%. Think he was, he was, you know, go get the girl.
I agree. The tunnel scene, we haven't talked about it, but there's not much to say other than it's iconic for a reason. If you don't remember it, it surprised me if you've already seen the movie but you've forgotten it, but it's the scene where they're trying to get to the location where the bug is escaping, and because there's traffic in the tunnel, he finally is allowed to push the red button, and it's this incredible sequence where the car goes upside down on the roof of the tunnel, and because Tommy Lee Jones has spent the entire movie, they set this up so well, has spent the entire movie telling Agent J to buckle up, and he doesn't. He, like, obviously, because it's upside down, falls down, and just a lot of slapstick comedy ensues while Tommy Lee Jones's Agent K is listening to, like, Elvis and singing along quite comfortably. It's just a really funny sequence. I really enjoy that one. I also really enjoy, he has a couple of really great lines, but particularly I liked him being like, I want to get my gun back, as his reason for going in the book. That's really good. Oh, we haven't talked about this. So, the bug itself. When Edgar finally strips himself of the Edgar suit, the bug itself looks really good. Now, it does look a bit sort of video gamey. Like, it doesn't look as real as, like, the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, which is a movie that predates this one. But it's quite cartoony in design. It almost feels like it's intentionally supposed to not look that real. Like, it feels like it's supposed to look a little... like, you know, the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park are designed to look photoreal where they can. Whereas I think the aliens in this are designed to look silly and cartoony. And I think that really works. Like, it's got a very expressive face. It moves in a really interesting way. Yeah, I think it's just a really good design. And I think it's executed really well. It blends into the world, as well as such a thing will. I think they did a good job on it altogether, both from the special effects perspective and the design perspective. I think it looks really cool.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Again, bus ticket, but not getting on the bus. How does Jay know that stepping on the bugs would be a problem for him? Because we have several scenes in the movie that, so for those who don't remember, Jay has to keep him on the planet, and how he does it is he stands on bugs and it upsets him. He's killing cockroaches, and it upsets Edgar / the bug. And that's what distracts him enough to be kept on the planet long enough for Kay to do what he needs to do to stop him. And there were several scenes in the movie that set this up, like the David Cross's character is like squishing flies, and he's like, "Don't do that," you know. He's getting annoyed at him, and there's a few scenes like that where someone tries to kill bugs and he gets upset. But Jay never witnesses any of that. Jay isn't present for any of the scenes where that happens. Guesswork?
What do the bugs come out of? Because he breaks something.
Yeah, it's like a metal something. Barrel. And he just sort of kicks it in. And cockroaches just conveniently fall out of it.
My assumption was, and I didn't rewind it to check it or anything, but my assumption was that barrel came from the truck that the guy had nicked. And basically what I took from it was that Jay had worked out that the guy had saved the bugs. Because there were a shitload of them. So my assumption was either they were drawn to him or he'd saved them. So Jay basically went, there are a shitload, he's got an affinity with bugs. What if I do this?
But wait, but they got the van off him. Because the van had his UFO in it. That's how he was going to leave the planet originally. And the MIB get that back.
Yeah, but he did then nick another. He nicked the vehicle of the... He nicked the tow truck, didn't he?
With the tow truck. But what does the tow truck have on it? Does that have his bug dispatching?
I don't know. That's what I'm saying. I can't remember exactly, nor check at this moment, and I may be completely wrong. But certainly in the moment, I went, oh, he's stockpiled those bugs and Jay has worked out that right. must mean he cares for them. But that could be way off.
Fascinating. Maybe. Okay, well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to headcanon that for the time being because, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, we forgot to mention the special effect when Tony Shalhoub gets his head shot off. That's fun. And he comes up and he's got a little tiny head and it grows back and his voice grows with it from tiny to the normal voice. Love that. Great effect.
And again, that effect holds up. Like,
yeah, it does. Still looks good.
It looks good.
Still looks good. Yeah, agreed. And I think they partly gotten away with it by making the aliens fairly cartoony rather than photoreal, but I think it works. I think it works.
Yeah.
Also, very quick, last note before we get into the truth, Chris. I quite like that Laurel is the one that blows up the bug.
I thought that was great. I thought that was so clever.
Yeah. Like, these two are pretty hapless. She's not exactly a damsel in distress, is she? I mean, she saves herself. Yeah. Like, he's taking her as a snack. And she, when they get there, they are in no way rescuing her. She has already gotten herself out of that situation.
And she's, while she keeps getting her memory wiped, she is beginning to piece all this together in general. So, yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Great bit of writing there. They don't make her the damsel at all. And I think that's surprising considering the era. But a welcome surprise. So, Chris, are you ready for trivia?
Let's triv it up!
I'm going to give you some Men in Black related trivia. Let's see. Steven Spielberg actually was a producer on this, as you probably noticed in the credits. And at some point when he was looking to get it off the ground, he thought about directing it himself. But in the end, he chose to step back and just be the producer. Several directors were approached. Quentin Tarantino was offered the chance to direct it at first, I believe, but turned it down. Eventually, they also even went to John Landis. Now, John Landis declined for the stupidest reason I've ever heard anyone decline anything. John Landis declined, feeling it was basically just the Blues Brothers with aliens. Now, he has admittedly since said that was very wrong, and he regrets turning down the film. But other than suits and glasses, how is this Blues Brothers? Like, what planet does this guy live on? That's insane. I know you don't want to repeat yourself in Hollywood, but suits and glasses do not a movie make. There's, you know... There's characters and story. And Blues Brothers will come back up on this podcast. I fucking love Blues Brothers, and I cannot wait to cover it eventually, because I'm fairly sure it's one you've not seen, Chris.
Oh, no, I've seen it.
Oh, you have seen the Blues Brothers. Oh, great. Good.
I've seen Blues Brothers 2000, yeah, or whatever that sequel too. Was called.
Sorry for our loss. So, yeah, we'll cover that at some point. But what a strange thing for Landis to feel about this movie.
That is very bizarre.
Yeah. Lowell Cunningham's comic book, The Men in Black, was actually obviously much darker and drier than the sort of family-orientated science fiction comedy the film ended up being. In the comics, the MIB survey not only extraterrestrial activity, but paranormal and supernatural activity on Earth as well. They're also they're allowed to maintain secrecy by any means necessary, including murder. So they kill people when they can't keep them quiet or erase their memories or whatever. They also have a secret agenda to manipulate and reshape the world in their own image by keeping the supernatural hidden. So they're a much darker organization in the comic that it comes from. I prefer this version.
Yeah, me too. I think this version's more fun.
Yeah, I agree. It's an interesting story, but I for what this is the right move. The film was originally going to be set across several hidden underground bases and locations, including Kansas and Washington, D.C. and Nevada. But director Barry Sonnenfeld made New York City the film's main Earth location. He thought it was more believable that aliens could hide out in a large city, safety in crowds, and also thought that New Yorkers would be more tolerant of people who behaved oddly, which is correct. He also felt that many of the city structures resembled flying saucers and rocket ships, which could potentially be real spacecraft and other hidden alien technology, which then got obviously worked into the script. So that's pretty cool. During the shoot, there was several script revisions that changed the basic role of the galaxy in the movie. The two Corellians at the restaurant were originally supposed to be two separate warring species who would exchange the galaxy to end the war. And when Edgar the Bug would steal it, it was because he wanted to keep the war going for some reason. Profiteering, maybe, or I'm not sure. But fortunately, some creative tricks were able to use to avoid needing reshoots to fix this when they changed it. So both Aquilarian, you know, they were speaking originally in English in the restaurant, but basically they used redubbing to make it an alien language. And then that could just be subtitled in with the new dialogue. So they had to reshoot anything. Similarly, Frank the Pug's dialogue could be changed without having to reshoot the scenes, just through post-production. Apparently on the DVD commentary, Barry Sonnenfeld has joked that other directors should include talking dogs in their movies for exposition. That'll make it easier for them to change the plot after filming. It's a good idea.
Yeah, I can't think of a single movie that I wouldn't watch. You know, if they released the talking dog cut, I can't think of a single movie where I wouldn't watch that.
Agreed. I think, I don't know, I guess giving the galaxy more of a purpose makes a certain amount of sense, but I think I prefer this simplified version.
You know what, I think this, as much as I thought the CGI didn't hold up, I thought the simplified version really came into effect at the end, where you see our galaxy is also in wider context, a marble-shaped galaxy alongside a load of other galaxies. I thought that was such an imaginative idea, and as a notion, really captured my imagination. So, yeah, I think especially with that ending, I think it works fine as it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. And I think... Well, I guess the galaxy's actual existence wouldn't have changed. It's more what it was representing, because obviously it would have been a pawn in a war between two warring species in the original draft. So I guess the galaxy itself wouldn't have changed. But yeah, we should very briefly talk about that, actually, because we didn't cover it. That ending, I found that brilliant and haunting as a child. Like, I was like, oh god, we are. It was like just a true representation of how insignificant we are. You know, we could easily be in a situation similar to that. It's quite it's just a really good idea. So Chris O'Donnell was first offered the role of Jay before Will Smith was, but turned it down because he thought it was another sort of new recruit role, and he just played Dick Grayson / Robin in Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. He didn't kind of want to repeat the premise. I think that's fair. I think those there is an element of similarity between those two characters in that they both sort of enter a sort of world from the normal and are, you know, sort of have a grumpy sort of instructor in Batman and Agent K. I can see how he drew a parallel.
I think that's fair.
Schwimmer was asked to play the role of Jay early on, Mr. David Schwimmer, but turned it down. I'm glad. I don't think Schwimmer would have made a very good Agent J, personally. He's a good actor. I just don't think that's the right role for him.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I think it needs to be someone older than he would have been at that time. Oh, no, wait. Jay is Will Smith. Yeah, I think that role... Will Smith just brought so much charisma to that role. And, you know, David Schwimmer's incredibly charismatic. But, you know, the Friends Association at the time...
It's a different energy, though, isn't it? It's not confidence. It's like... What's the opposite? could he have brought, like, a confidence to that role the way that Will Smith did? I don't know.
That would have been insane, though. Imagine being in what would have been at the time, Series 3, presumably of filming Series 2 of Friends. Like, think about how big Friends was in its second season. And the notion that he'd fit in around that filming Men in Black, like, crazy.
Yeah, he'd have a very different career if that had worked out for him, I think, because I think afterwards he would have been in quite well positioned to just be a movie star. In terms of Agent K,
it's probably not that bold, but I'm gonna counter that. I don't think this film is as successful without Will Smith, I'll be honest. Still, that probably would have been a hit. But I don't think it would have been the monster it was.
Because I did just say myself that I'm not sure, you know, the character would have worked quite as well with Trimmer. Yeah, you're right. That's a fair point. That is a fair point. I think I agree with that. In terms of Agent K, there weren't as many people in line for it. They got to Tommy Lee Jones pretty quickly, but one other name they did consider was Clint Eastwood. I think Clint Eastwood would have done a good job. If someone says you've got to do alternate casting for one of those two roles, and it's either going to be Schwimmer for Jay or Eastwood for K, which one are you picking? I'm picking the one that has the least impact on the movie, and I think that's Eastwood for K. I love what Tommy Lee Jones does in this movie. I wouldn't change it if I didn't have to, but if that was my scenario, I think that is a more sensible casting than the Schwimmer one, I think.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah. So Tommy Lee Jones only accepted the role of K after Spielberg promised the script would improve. He had been disappointed with the first draft, which he felt did not capture the tone of the comic. Now that's interesting, because that implies Tommy Lee Jones was either a fan of or became a fan of the comic in the build-up to doing this. Like, they either gave him copies of the comic to read, or he already was a fan.
just contradicts that reputation that man has, doesn't
it? Yeah, it does. It does. Yeah, absolutely. Will Smith, on the other hand, was actually also reluctant to accept the role, but for a different reason. A year back, he'd starred in Independence Day, and he didn't want to make another movie about aliens, but apparently it was his wife, Jada Pinkett Smith, who convinced him to take the part. So smart lady. She was right.
Fair play.
Apparently, the reason Will Smith's name even came up in the conversation is because once the other options I already spoke about sort of declined on the role, Barry Sonnenfeld's wife, who had been a fan of The Fresh Prince, sort of suggested him, basically. And he liked his performance in Six Degrees of Separation. So that's where Will Smith's name came into the equation. And what a stroke of luck and genius that was. Linda Fiorentino actually won her role in this movie. She played a poker game with Barry Sonnenfeld and won the game of poker, and the prize was a role in the movie.
That is a phenomenal fact.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that.
Jeez.
Work. Sonnenfeld actually considered playing the morgue attendant himself, but after doing some attempts at casting, he thought David Cross had essentially the same sensibility. That's fair. David Cross is great in this film, even though it's only a small role.
Brilliant.
Vincent D'Onofrio researched his role as Edgar by watching a lot of documentaries about bugs, and in order to achieve his character's distinctive walk, he put on knee braces so he couldn't bend his leg and taped up his ankles.
Oh, that is commitment, isn't it? Jeez.
Yeah, he taped up his ankles too. That must have been so unpleasant to walk in. Ugh. God. I mean, respect to the man, obviously. That's effort, but no thank you. So Sonnenfeld has claimed that he had to deliberately direct Tommy Lee Jones to play every scene straight. Jones reportedly would become frustrated he wasn't allowed to do comedic takes of the dialogue, but Sonnenfeld insisted Agent K had to be completely serious for the comedy to work. Now, I 100% agree with that sentiment. I would resist the notion that Tommy Lee Jones regularly complained he wasn't getting to be comedic. I feel like he's smart enough to know that he's the straight man.
Yeah, and experienced enough to know that, you know?
Right. He understands what a straight man is in a comedic duo setting. I find it hard to believe. It wouldn't surprise me if there were a couple of days when he did lean comedic on the delivery and the director had to step in and say, hey, maybe pull that one back a little, just keep it straight. And he's like, oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah. And, that having that wouldn't surprise me. The idea that he, regularly complained about it, I smell some history rewriting going on there. That doesn't sit right with me, that one. That's according to Sonnenfeld anyway, so who knows. So the American Humane Society were on set to ensure no animals were hurt during filming, including the cockroaches. Will Smith was actually crushing mustard packets at the end of the film. And at the end of each day of shooting, they had to count all of the individual cockroaches to make sure none had gone missing.
That is crazy, isn't it, that when you think that that was happening with a film in America in 1997 and we're still dealing with sort of the insect bug thing of I'm a Celebrity.
Yeah.
A UK reality show which, every year it receives criticism for the way they use animals. And, just knowing they were counting the cockroaches... And, in I'm a Celebrity, they're slinging them over people who are then able to crush them potentially and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and that's what's crazy to me is, cockroaches would be hard to count if they stayed still as it was.
Mm.
I don't know how you count cockroaches if they're all in, a box or whatever and they're running around. Because the second you count one, it's moved to the other side of the fucking box. Yeah, that sounds like a nightmare. Just from a logistics perspective. So, there are a bunch of quote-unquote known aliens visible on the screen. A couple of notable names that have been clocked. Al Roker, Danny DeVito, the director Barry Sonnenfeld himself, his own daughter, Sylvester Stallone, Newt Gingrich, and George Lucas, and even executive producer Steven Spielberg, all listed as aliens in that. Apparently, they wanted Michael Jackson to be in there. But instead, Michael Jackson wanted to play the J role. And they were like, no, thank you.
Hence why they've ended what they did in the sequel.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep. He was like, I'll be in your movie, but I want to be J. And they were like, we do not want that. So that didn't...
Which I think was a wise choice.
Yeah, Mr. Sunday Movies has an amazing video of all of the movies Michael Jackson tried to force his way into. He wanted to be Professor X at one point, like in an X-Men movie. Like it's honestly, Michael Jackson has this insane history of trying to be in movies, and it is like it's really like it's hard to believe some of the stories, but they're all reportedly true. So it's crazy. Anyway, we're nearly there, Chris. Don't worry.
It's cool, baby.
The explanation that Kay originally puts in Patrice's head is actually an Easter egg for UFO geeks. It's a nonsensical mix of four famous or infamous cases of scientific explanations of UFO sightings that the US government gave, including swamp gas, most famously Dr. J. Allen Hynek's explanation of the Michigan sighting, the weather balloon, the original explanation for the Roswell incident, thermal pocket, which was the mass Washington, D.C. UFO sightings from 52, and light from Venus, arguably the most famous and frequently used explanation of UFO sightings. So the big, long explanation he gives combines all four of those. I think that is fun.
Yeah, I think that's great.
Yeah, that is good. The little ball Jay accidentally sends smashing around the MIB headquarters is said to Kay to be a practical joke from The Great Attractor. The Great Attractor is a real thing. It's a gravitational anomaly about 250 million light years from Earth, which affects the motion of every galaxy within 100 million light years of it. It was first detected by astronomers in 1973. That is a deep cut. Well done, writers.
Fair play.
So, at the end of this film, Agent J reveals that to Agent L that Dennis Rodman is actually an alien. But in some countries, particularly in Europe, where Dennis Rodman was not as famous, they had to change it. So in Germany, in Spain, and in France, they changed it to Michael Jackson, ironically.
So does that mean there's an alternative take of them saying that?
What's that, sorry?
It was ADR. Does that mean there's an alternative take of them saying Michael Jackson, or was it like ADR?
It will have been ADR, because my assumption is that when they did it in Germany and France, they will have done it into German and French and Spanish. So it would have been the dub actor can just say the new name, and it, you know, you wouldn't know the difference. That makes sense that Dennis Rodman wasn't particularly well known in you know. So yeah, it's, you know, the representative from that planet wants to see a concert. We're going to go look at them to see Michael Jackson. You know, he is one of their species. The joke works exactly the same. You just got to adjust the dialogue. So, some numbers. So, the sunglasses used by the Men in Black are the Ray-Ban Predator 2 glasses. After the film's release, Ray-Ban reported the sales of these glasses tripled from 1.6 million to 5 million.
Not in any way, shape, or form surprising, is it?
No, not at all. And even one thing that does surprise me, though, is at the end of the movie, they both are wearing different styles of suit and glasses to what they were wearing in the earlier part of the movie. Like, Jay's second suit in this movie is very outside of what the Men in Black normally wear. And it feels almost a little too attention-drawing. Like, I thought the whole idea of the suit and sunglasses was to be, like, a bit inconspicuous. But, yeah, there you go. So yeah, 5 million they made from those glasses after that. It's crazy. The crew blew up a 25-gallon drum of blue goo for the scene at the beginning of the movie. Yeah, that sounds about right. the movie grossed $589 million on a budget of 90. So even if you double that for marketing, as is the rule, and you say they spent somewhere in the region of 200 million, they still made just short of 600 million profit. Not profit, total. So they made about 400 million profit on that movie at the, and that's not including DVD, VHS, you know, streaming now, whatever they've earned from it subsequently from royalties and stuff. Will Smith turned 30 the year this film was released, and J is the 10th letter of the alphabet. And you're wondering, why is that relevant, Dan? Well, if you add the 90 million budget of the film to the 25-gallon drum of goo, the 5 million in glasses sales, Will Smith's age, and the 10, which is the number of letter of the alphabet J is, you have 160, which was indeed the number of pairs of glasses Daniel Radcliffe wore during the Harry Potter films.
Very good. Nice new take on it. Well done.
That took a while to put together, I'm not going to lie. I had to find that 10 from somewhere. Nadia was like, wait, is J the 10th letter of the alphabet? I was like, yeah, it is.
Very nice. Very nice.
Thank you. Thank you. And before we get to Kazi, just one last little piece of trivia. Lowell Cunningham, who was the writer of the comic, gets a little appearance in the movie. It appears briefly as a short-sleeved MIB office employee during the scene when
nice.
Jay is brought through the office. All right, Chris. Nothing major, but we do have Cars Exist.
Meow.
So, the automobile that agents K and J drive, which Jay describes as a Ford POS, is actually a 1987 Ford LTD Crown Victoria. Now, the designer who built this modified version, because it is modified, actually ended up buying it from the studio following the movie and still owns it to this day. That's fun. And then a little subsection, Chris. Guns exist. The shotgun that Edgar uses is a 12-gauge Winchester model 1897. Boom. We did it. We did it!
Nice. We're not going to... You know, there's lots of guns in some of these movies. Are we going to start doing Guns Exist?
No, it was just that someone bothered to put it in on the IMDb, and I thought that was funny.
Ah, fair enough. Right, cool. Fine.
Like, I didn't look up what the gun was. It was there, and I just thought it was funny that someone had gone to the trouble of putting it in. So...
Ah, fair enough, fair enough. Yeah. Well done. Before we do where the people can get us, where are we going next, Dan?
Super Mario Brothers movie. No, I'm kidding. we're finally doing the Indiana Jones movies. I'm very excited about this. I have not seen these in a very long time. I love these movies as a kid. This is our trilogy for the season. Every season of Rewind Reviews, we've sort of had a pattern of doing a trilogy. And the Indiana Jones trilogy, the original trilogy, seems like a good thing to do now in the wake of Dial of Destiny coming out.
Yep.
So in the lead up to that, we're going to review Raiders, Temple of Doom, and Last Crusade. Starting, of course, next week with Raiders of the Lost Ark. I'm not sure what your point of reference for these movies are. Have you've seen them? They've been in the background. Have you? I'm not sure. Have you ever seen them? I can't remember.
Well, tune in next week. No, I've seen the first one once as a part of a media studies assignment at A level. So, yeah, not a rich history with it.
Interesting. Well, there you go. Did you enjoy it? Do you remember enjoying it?
I did enjoy it. Yeah, I remember enjoying it. But also, I was had to, like, you know, it was homework, so I think that affected it slightly. So I didn't, you know, rush out to watch the others. But I do remember enjoying it, certainly.
Well, the audience don't know this, but we're recording it in like 2 days, so get cracking.
Oh yeah. I didn't put that together. How quickly we're recording it from this? Yeah. I need to squeeze that in.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking about how I'm going to do that. I might watch it tomorrow morning before I go to work. Anyway, so that's that. Do the people need to know what it goes? Do you want to do that this week? I feel like I've talked for about 6 hours, Chris, because of Indiana Jones being my pick and the trivia. So do you want to do the where the people can find us?
Sure thing. I always get this wrong. Email at nothingbutstatic@gmail.com. Is that the email?
It's so close. No, it's mail at nothingbutstatic.
Ah, closer than I normally get it.
And it's mail@nothingbutstatic.com.
Mail at nothingbutstatic.co.uk, youtube.com/nothingbutstatic
UK,
or just nothing, yep. UK, yep. Nothingbutstatic UK. Twitter we don't really use, but you can like us, patreon.com/nothingbutstatic. There, for as little as $1, you can get the episodes a week early. If you want to find out what we thought of Indiana Jones, you can check it out right now. It's there, it's waiting for you, baby. As well as some extra fun stuff. I know we always say that, but we literally have two things pre-recorded that we're just waiting to get a couple more under our belt.
I imagine by the time this goes out in sort of 7-8 weeks, that they'll be up. So yeah, at least the first two episodes of Nothing But Lyrics.
Yeah, should hopefully maybe be up. It is us, Dan. But yes, I agree. Hopefully they will be there. But so, yeah, there is extra content coming. But also, you know, you get the episodes a week early and it's great to have your support. If you can't afford it, we get it. You know, it's difficult times out there in terms of money, etc. So not a problem at all. If you can't support, we appreciate you for listening all the same. If you want to support in a potentially more cost-effective way, then liking, sharing, or whatever the podcast platform of choice allows you to do, you know, if that's writing a review, if that's adding it to favorites, whatever it is, all of that stuff helps us potentially appear in other feeds, appear as recommendations, and helps us out quite a bit. So if you fancy doing that, that would be brilliant. Equally, if you don't particularly feel you want to do that either and just want to keep listening, then you know, we're very grateful for your listens. So thank you very much. There you go.
I think you're it.
Yeah.
I think people should keep listening.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm happy for you not to support financially or not to like or whatever, but if you're listening, God damn it, keep listening.
Yep. That's yeah. where I'm at.
There we go. No, seriously, if you want to give up, we basically have, so why not? I'm joking.
Cool. So with that said, that's everything for this week. Thank you all so much. Oh, it's Crystal's This Bit too. Sorry.
Yeah. It's all right. No problem at all. Here we go. Strap in. Oh. Here come the men in black. I've been Chris Billingham.
I've been Dan Doolin.
And this review has been rewound. Dun 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 dun. Nod your head, the black suit's coming.
Oh man. Yeah, bye. Since we could have the Men in Black trilogy. I don't know. I feel like we dodged a bullet with that though.
Yeah, I think we're getting away with it, but I guess we're still recording. We're getting away with it, I think, even though there's four movies in Indiana Jones, the original trilogy was released so close together that I think we can count it more than Men in Black, where the third one was actually quite a way away from two. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We put too much thought into this, don't we?
We do, yeah, for sure. Especially, I want to do that. I want to do one year, I want to just do sequels to all the stuff we've started but not done the sequels of yet.
Oh, that's a funny idea for a series. Are we still recording? Are you still recording?
I am, are you?
Yeah, I am as well. Is this in? Yeah. Are we keeping this in? Are we just teasing that now? That's the thing? Okay, fine,
In case people want it. Because I think there's probably 10 movies, 11 movies that have sequels that we've not done yet. But we'll do the maths on that.
I don't think we'd have trouble doing that.
No. Anyway, catch you later.
Take care, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.